From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The cycle of violence between Israel and the Palestinians can seem horribly unchanging. But in fact, there is an evolution. Israel returned Gaza to the Palestinians. Hamas won a vote. Hamas took over. Israel clamped what is now a five-year embargo on the Gaza Strip. Hamas rockets flew and flew farther. Israel invaded. Now, Israel is pounding Gaza again, but Egypt, the great Arab neighbor, has changed. So has the region. This hour on Point, Israel, the Palestinians, and the fight this time. You can join the conversation. Does Egypt's new president, Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood, change the equation? Will he or something else keep Israeli tanks from going in again to Gaza? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We're going to go to Cairo and get the view from the here. Explosions over Gaza City yesterday as Israeli airstrikes targeted tunnels and more. It's crowded. Plenty of civilians have died. Plenty of other things taken out as well. A lot. And there's a mass of Israeli troops and heavy equipment on the borders of Gaza. On Friday, President Mohamed Morsi of Egypt spoke on state television.
We support the people of Gaza. We are with them in their trenches. What hurts them hurts us. And the blood that flows from their children is our blood too.
Fresh sympathy from the Muslim Brotherhood, former leader now head of the entire country of Egypt. Speaking on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, Lindsey Graham, Republican senator, South Carolina, had a message for Egypt's leaders.
Egypt, watch what you do and how you do it. You're teetering with the Congress on having your aid cut off if you keep inciting violence between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Lindsey Graham warning Egypt. Joining us now from Cairo is Nancy Youssef. She's Middle East Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers. Nancy Youssef, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
So, first of all, to the talks apparently going on in Cairo to try and find a truce here or some way out of this more than flare-up, do you see any progress there, Nancy?
Well, we keep hearing that they're close. We've been hearing this since Saturday. I just spoke to a source that says it could be in the next 24 hours or so that there doesn't seem to be a particular sticking point, but rather the time that it takes to shuttle between two sides that won't sit down face to face. At the same time, we're still seeing explosions in Gaza, although less so, relatively speaking, than yesterday, which also suggests that perhaps there's some movement. And Khaled Mishael, who is the head of Hamas, just held a press conference here in which he said morale was sky high, but also again gave little indications that his group was open to some sort of truce. So there is a sort of feeling that it's imminent, but again, we've been hearing this for a few days now, and so it's all wait and see in Cairo right now.
And what about Mohamed Morsi, the president of Egypt, and his nation? Of course, a long, long relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas. What about the public's expectations of him? How do you characterize that? Is it a high wire he's on here, Nancy?
It sure is, because, you know, President Mubarak, his predecessor, certainly couldn't ignore the public, but he had more leeway. Mohamed Morsi, one of the key tenets that he was elected on was that Egypt would be a bigger supporter of the Palestinian people. There was a lot of resentment amongst everyday Egyptians about Mubarak's stance, and so what you've heard since this began was a real change in rhetoric from Egypt's leaders, from Morsi, as you played earlier in the show, from Prime Minister Kandil during his visit to Gaza. But at the same time, practically speaking, there doesn't seem to be an indication of major changes. The fact that there was a ceasefire announced during Kandil's visit suggests that some sort of negotiation had gone on between the Israelis and the Egyptians. And the fact that Egypt is in the midst of this negotiation and still seen as the most important broker for a peace agreement. And from what we see, Morsi continues to be a pragmatist in this issue, that he understands that instability next door means instability for Egypt, and that this is a real test of him as a world leader. And so all those factors are coming into play such that rhetorically, we're hearing a different Egypt, but substantively, we haven't seen a major change yet.
Nancy, is there any difference in Egypt's physical support of Hamas this time? We're reading about the Palestinians being evacuated out of Gaza to Egyptian hospitals. Is there anything new on the ground in terms of the Egyptian military or other support for Hamas in this confrontation?
nothing major. Remember that even though Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood was very close to Hamas, the army and intelligence services are still very distrustful of them. And so they are the ones that are likely to hold back on that and limit Morsi's ability to sort of show outward support. So we're seeing changes on the ground for sure, but nothing that I would call major or something that indicates a major policy change.
Nancy Youssef with McClatchy Newspapers, Middle East Bureau Chief there in Cairo. Nancy, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Here's the sound of an amateur video taken last Wednesday. It shows a rocket, Palestinian rocket attack, hitting Be'er Sheva, Israel. You hear the air raid warning siren in the background. Here's Israeli President Shimon Peres. He's speaking with the UK's Sky News yesterday about Israel's right to defend itself.
Hamas is shooting at our settlements, at our houses, at our kindergartens, at our schools. What would any other country do but to try to stop it?
But here's Hamas Deputy Foreign Minister Ghazi Hamad saying yesterday in an interview with Sky News that Israeli firepower is vastly overwhelming that of Hamas.
We have no aircraft, no tanks, no massive weapons like Israel. So you should not blame us as the Palestinians. We are still under the occupation, and we are fighting in order to defend ourselves.
The voice of the Hamas deputy foreign minister there. Joining me now from Washington is Robert Malley. He's director of the Middle East and North Africa program at the International Crisis Group, former special assistant to Bill Clinton for Arab-Israeli affairs. Robert Malley, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us in Washington is Natan Sachs, fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, focuses on Israeli policy and politics. Natan Sachs, thank you very much for being here.
Pleasure to be with you, Tom.
Natan, first put this in the context of what's going on inside Israel. Where are we in the Israeli political calendar here?
Well, we're looking at elections in January 2013, so we're very late in the electoral cycle and looking at elections coming up. Netanyahu, even before this operation, was riding very high in the polls, very likely to form the next coalition. Defense Minister Barak was actually doing very badly in the polls, perhaps even not making it into parliament. So there's some speculation that may have something to do with it, although I would take those claims with a grain of salt.
Because Netanyahu was in strong shape even before this flare-up.
Exactly. And these kinds of operations are very unpredictable, especially if a ground operation starts, which everyone, I think, hopes doesn't. Things could get very bad, and the damage could be great. And so Netanyahu earlier on was actually doing very well. The safeguard politically for him would have been to avoid this. It may be a different calculus for the defense minister.
Robert Malley, 2008, we saw Operation Cast Lead. Lots of Israeli troops went into Gaza. How do you measure the odds or the danger of that happening again this time? They're masked. They're right there. Do you think they'll go in?
At this point, I would say it's unlikely, but as you just heard, it is possible. It's possible because in these kinds of fights, each side wants to end on a victory and be able to claim that it won. And if Hamas continues to fire rockets and if it could show that it's not going to buckle under Israeli pressure, at some point the pressure may grow in Israel to do what I think its leaders knows is a very risky gamble and which its international allies, whether in the U.S., in the U.K. or elsewhere, are warning them against doing, which is launching a ground operation which, because it could have heavy civilian casualties, could really backfire on Israel.
If there would be a ground operation again, how do you see that playing out in Egypt? And what about Egypt's role if that unfolds, Robert?
I think, as you said in the opening, this is an old war being fought on a new battlefield, a new battleground. It's the same protagonists, but they're very different at the same time. And the biggest change is what's happened in Egypt, where you now have the Muslim Brotherhood, which is leading the country. And the Muslim Brotherhood is a parent organization of Hamas, and historically has been criticizing its predecessors, President Mubarak in particular, for being Israel's lapdog and for being impotent in the face of attacks against Palestinians. So there's a real test now about whether President Morsi's bark is going to be greater than his bite and whether he's going to do more than Mubarak did. If there is a ground operation, and Egypt does very little, does nothing active to prevent it in any way, and frankly, it's hard to see what they can do in these circumstances, he'll come under tremendous domestic pressure, and he's going to have to balance that against his other priority, which is to maintain good relations with the U.S., good relations with the West, continue to get international funding and support, and if he engages in something that's viewed as reckless, he could jeopardize all that.
Natan, we heard Morsi's rhetoric there, very hot, that, you know, the blood of the Palestinians is our blood, but there's the bark. Is there a bite? Is there something material Egypt could do or is doing or might do in case of an invasion this time with Morsi at its head?
Well, the big strategic issue, as Rob pointed out, is really the Israeli-Egyptian sort of relation here. If things deteriorate dramatically, there's fear on all sides that something might happen along the Israeli-Egyptian border. And things have already been happening in the past year or two. Attacks, some of them with connection to Gaza. The Egyptians have been taking a very Egyptian stance. They've been much more Egyptian than Islamists or Arab in some regards. And that's especially true with regard to the military and the intelligence, which has continued to coordinate with the Israelis. The two countries, of course, have a peace treaty. And by and large, it has been maintained, despite the rhetoric from Morsi, similar to the rhetoric we heard earlier. So the big question is whether down the road this could undermine what is really a strategic pillar of Israeli national security, but also of U.S. interests in the region, and frankly also of Egyptian interests.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Israel and Hamas, the Palestinians this time, and what's changed with Egypt reshaped and a region on edge. Robert Malley joins us from the International Crisis Group, director of the Middle East and North Africa program there. Natan Sachs is with us, this from the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Just reading headlines as we speak, Los Angeles police reporting a street clash between Palestinian supporters and a pro-Israeli group in California. In Gaza City, Islamic Jihad saying one of its top leaders was killed after an Israeli strike on a media center in Gaza City. Top floor of a high-rise there hit. Lots of news organizations there, including foreign news organizations. At a cabinet meeting yesterday, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke about Israel's actions in Gaza. Good Morning America reported on the Prime Minister's comments.
"We're exacting a heavy price from Hamas," said Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, "and the military is prepared for a significant expansion of its operations."
Prepared for significant expansion at a press conference in Bangkok, Thailand, yesterday on his Asia swing. President Obama spoke about the conflict in Israel and Gaza.
"We are fully supportive of Israel's right to defend itself from missiles landing on people's homes and workplaces and potentially killing civilians. And we will continue to support Israel's right to defend itself."
President Obama in Bangkok. Robert Malley, why do you see this happening now? Is it because of the, hundreds now of rockets coming out of Gaza in recent days, weeks? Is there something more? And if it's that, why that flurry of rockets most lately? From the Palestinians, of course, their Hamas militant commander assassinated by Israel last week. I guess you could put even a why on that. What's brought all this to this point of violence now?
I think that is the big why. I mean, you know, both sides, as is always the case between them, have very different narratives about what started what. And each side will point to an action that the other one took as causing the escalation, which had begun, you know, several weeks ago. There was a larger number of rocket fire. There's also more Israeli incursions into Gaza. The turning point, the game change, was Israel's decision to kill Mr. Jabari, who was the mastermind of so much of Hamas's military operations, one of the masterminds of the operation that kidnapped an Israeli corporal several years ago. He was a key figure in Hamas's structure, and so the decision to go after him was made knowing that this would cause the kind of escalation we're seeing. So I think the question is, why did Israel choose to do it? I think Natan is right that the electoral politics may be a small piece of it. It's a piece, but I think only a small piece that may explain the specific timing. I think beyond that has been a growing sense in Israel, a fear in Israel, that because of events in Egypt and the rest of the region, Hamas felt emboldened as if it was under a cloak of immunity, that Israel would not dare resume its attacks against Gaza in any intense way because of their concern about how Egypt would react and how others in the region would react. And I think this is Israel's way of saying things haven't changed all that much.
Natan, what's your interpretation? Why the assassination of Ahmed al-Jabari, the Hamas militant commander, last week? You know, I mean, there have been weeks of rockets and a surge in rockets out of Gaza, but why now?
As Rob said, the Israelis saw the Hamas stance as changing, as one that felt emboldened because of the changes in the region and especially in Cairo, but also elsewhere. We saw the visit of the Emir of Qatar recently in the Gaza Strip, which was a dramatic change in the diplomatic stance of the Gaza Strip controlled by Hamas. This whole conflict should be seen in the context of the previous big round we had in 2008-2009 with the Israelis called Cast Lead. Mm-hmm. And after that, a very bloody conflict that included a ground operation. After that conflict, we saw a kind of deterrence between the two sides. And it's not that Hamas didn't fire, but by and large, the rockets that were fired then were by other groups in the Gaza Strip, and especially the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and also smaller groups. And Palestinian Islamic Jihad is much closer connected to Iran. Hamas, the large group that controls Gaza, usually either stayed out of the fire or even policed it and prevented it. That has changed. So from the Israeli perspective, the Hamas basic understanding of the deterrence between the two sides after Cast Lead had changed and deteriorated dramatically. And for the Israelis, this was, or one might interpret their action as trying to reestablish that kind of deterrence. When they killed Ahmed Jabri, just as Rob said, they knew exactly what's going to happen. They knew that this was a dramatic escalation. That is why they coupled the assassination with a strike against the stockpiles of medium-range missiles, Iranian-made missiles, that that Hamas was holding in the Gaza Strip.
Natan Roberts, stand by. Our listeners seem to have a lot to say about this. Paul in Atkinson, New Hampshire. Paul, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Tom, my comment is this. It appears to me that this is actually a preemptive move on Netanyahu's part to mitigate the Hamas reaction to a inevitable attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. He's not only been able to take out the missile silos that would have probably been fired at Israel in response to an attack in Iran, but at the same time, he's been able to call up the 75,000 ground troops, which will be necessary, you know, in a war like that, and also open up the air raids shelters for the people, all under the pretext of going after Hamas. But the real objective is to mitigate Hamas and now go after Iran.
Paul, you pulled the curtain back very wide, very quickly there. Robert Malley, what about that? The prelude to an attack on Iranian nuclear facilities?
I don't think so. Let me give several reasons, and I'm sure that there are many possibilities, but if this had happened a few years ago when Hamas was much closer to Syria and to Iran, it would be one thing. Now they're kind of divorced with those two countries, and they're much closer to Egypt, to Qatar, to Turkey, countries that have not particularly good relations with Iran. So I don't think that Israel fears that much that Hamas would go after it in case it attacked Iran. The real fear comes from the north, from Hezbollah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And beyond that, I don't think, nobody that I know is thinking that Israel is on the verge of attacking Iran. It's Prime Minister Netanyahu gave President Obama several months to try to negotiate an agreement. So calling up reservists and all the other steps that we're taking, I don't think the timing really works. I think the main reasons are the ones that Natan and I were mentioning earlier. But of course, I think keep in mind the possibility that this is just the first of a series of conflicts that Israel may face in the coming year with Hezbollah, with Iran. Even though they may not be immediately related, they certainly fall within the realm of possibility over the coming months.
Well, let's test our caller's theory a little more here, Natan. What about it? The possibility that this could be in part Israel pulling the teeth of an adversary in advance of a potential conflict with Iran?
Well, as Rob mentioned, if Israel were truly preparing for a strike on Iran in the very near future, the real front would be in the north, would be against Hezbollah. Hezbollah has far more leeway and also many more rockets than Hamas. The Hamas threat is considerable over time, but it is not a formidable threat in conflict. And so the conflict in the south, to a large degree, diverts Israeli attention and resources. This is very expensive for Israel to do, of course. Don't forget that considerable portions of the country are in bomb shelters right now. And the troops that the caller mentioned being called up, those are people who are out of the workforce who need to be paid via the military. This is a very expensive operation. An operation in the north, perhaps, would be slightly more suggestive. But again, Netanyahu at the United Nations made it quite clear that until the spring, Israel is giving some diplomatic time. Anything could be a ruse, of course, but I highly doubt it. Come springtime, we may see an escalation of the rhetoric and of the chances of conflict with Iran. But a lot of that depends on what happens between Washington and the P5+1, the five permanent members of the Security Council.
But couldn't this be a kind of deep prep for something with Iran in the spring? I mean, to reduce the threat from the south when you've got these new rockets. I mean, these, how do you say it, Fajr 5 rockets, the ones that are being aimed toward Tel Aviv. These are 2,000-pound rockets, a warhead of 375 pounds, I'm reading here. Now, a bunch of these have been taken down by the anti-rocket, anti-missile system, but wouldn't that be of value if Israel went after Iran and suddenly had Hezbollah fire from the north, Natan?
It would to a certain degree, but the vast majority of these rockets, the Fajr 5s, were taken out by the Air Force in one strike or several, or one series of strikes at the very beginning when they assassinated Jabari. Hezbollah has many more of these rockets. And in fact, the Iron Dome system, the anti-missile or anti-rocket system that Israel now has been extremely effective. And this is another important change since 2008, 2009. The Israelis and the Israeli public and the government feel that they have something active to do defensively. And ironically, this might help prevent Israel from going in a ground operation, which is still possible, of course, because there is a sense that Israel is not vulnerable to these rockets by a small organization. So if Israel were really preparing for Iran, I think an operation in the north would have been much more likely, and it would not have diverted all these resources and attention south to a relatively small foe compared to Iran or Hezbollah.
David in New York, Roslyn, New York. David, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment that I thought that Syria was the really big domino in this. You saw Egypt as well as Libya fall. And just I'll leave you with this, is that it's almost as if Hamas and PLO, et cetera, had been pushed to page 26 and they're crying out right now.
What do you mean by that, David?
Well, it's not been something that's been on the cover. In the past, it's been a issue that has been on. I'm not speaking too eloquently. My apologies.
No problem.
Basically, I'm saying that this has been something that has been raging for decades. And now what we're finding is that whenever it would spark up, it would be the lead story. There is so much that's going on in that particular region, and so much change, seismic change, that the next domino that needs to fall and need the tension. I mean, we're talking about, and I've listened to your show, and you're talking about 30,000 plus civilians in Syria being killed. That's going to take precedent over other issues in the area.
So maybe Syria kind of occupying the foreground, though Syria's had trouble really staying, at least in the United States, in the foreground of news coverage. But David, let us pick that up. Robert Malley, what about Syria and what's going on there and how that might or might not factor in to the whole regional picture we're seeing here around the latest focus on Israel and Hamas?
I think David is right that the issue, the Palestinian issue, not just the issue of Hamas, but the issue of the occupation, the issue of what's happening in the West Bank, has really been pushed to the back pages because of everything that's happened since 2011 and the Arab uprisings, the most recent being Syria. I mean, it's true that what's happening in Syria is of such tragic proportions that people naturally have, and Arabs as well, have looked at that and tended to ignore what's happened among in the Palestinian
arena. It's overwhelming.
Part of the irony, of course, is for Netanyahu, who would like to forget about the Palestinian issue. Two events are going to bring it back. One of them, by his own volition, what's happened in Gaza to some extent, to the extent that that Israel escalated it by killing Ahmed Jabari. Mm-hmm. But also we are going to have in a few weeks potentially the Palestinian president coming to the UN and seeking an upgrade of its status there. So two events are going to bring the Palestinian issue, which the Israeli leadership would have preferred, I would suspect, not to have on the front page of the newspapers and keep them on the back burner. They're going to be back. How it affects these other Syria, you know, I think Syria, unfortunately for the Syrians, has its own tragic dynamic of its own. As we're speaking, as the escalation and the pounding of Gaza takes place, at least 100 Syrians are being killed every day. It's not in any way lessened the level of violence there.
Natan, I want to bring that one to you first, if I may. Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Daniel's calling. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm just struck by how little Israel seems to have to gain in any of this right now, and I was wondering if you and your experts could comment on what, given all his posturing, Netanyahu might be able to do to engage Abbas and Fatah in this and the opportunities there. And then also, moving forward, what should Israel's larger geopolitical strategic position be given the sea change, given that the democratic Arab Spring should generally be good for a democratic Israel, but that, say, Morsi and other leaders have had to hold the same traditional lines of being generally skeptical of Israel.
Hey, may I ask you, Daniel, we heard Netanyahu say there in the tape we played earlier, or Shimon Peres, look, we had to do this because rockets are landing on Israel. But you're saying, well, they don't have much to gain, and why are they doing it now? What about the rockets themselves? Is that not reason enough or not, Daniel?
I think, you know, when you listen to someone with the record of Peres talk about the need to defend yourselves, you have to take that credibly and seriously. You look at the panic on the streets in cities like Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, where citizens generally see themselves as immune to the threats, or have for a long time sort of dealt with it as normalcy. At the same time, in terms of a ground invasion, in terms of the escalation, it just seems like everything needs to be done. And it looks like we might be heading there to wrap this up quickly, to avoid, to delay, and to focus on a more sustainable long-term solution.
We'll see, and we'll look at that. Thanks for your call. Natan, if we may, just roll the tape back here to Hamas again for a minute. To the greater number of rockets with longer range coming out in recent days, weeks, months. How do you interpret the reason for that? Is that an effort to provoke Israel? Is it an effort to get Israel into some kind of negotiation or bargaining? Is it just rage after 5 years of the embargo and all the difficulties in Gaza?
It's hard to interpret exactly what the reasoning is between the grand wave, partly because each one of the events, as Rob mentioned in the beginning, follows a narrative that each of the sides have. So many of the events for Hamas were a response to a specific event, which the Israelis themselves see as a response to another. In the grander picture, the Israelis at least, the intelligence has been seeing a lot of armaments coming in to the Gaza Strip via Sinai, via Egypt. Originating perhaps from Sudan, perhaps from Libya, where a lot of arms became available after the overthrow of Gaddafi there.
Including and rocket so and missile parts that are reassembled, we read, then in Gaza. Is that a mark of Egypt's change, that flow? Is that newly permitted because Mohamed Morsi's in power?
I wouldn't interpret it as an actual explicit permission by the Egyptians. The Egyptian military intelligence would very much prefer that Sinai be calm and that their authority be reestablished there. But the breakdown of authority in the Sinai Peninsula is very troubling for all involved, and it permits the smuggling of a lot of things, including weapons, into the Gaza Strip. And so we've seen Hamas emboldened both diplomatically and in the perception that history is on their side now. The Sunni Islamist organizations are on the ascendance in many places, and especially in Egypt.
But what does that mean, that they think they could rocket their way to a success of some kind?
Well, I think as the caller pointed out very well, the actor that's being forgotten here is Abbas, the Palestinian president and the leadership in Ramallah. And Abbas was about to go to the United Nations, scheduled for the 29th. This dynamic, the internal Palestinian dynamic, is very important. And so a lot of what Hamas is trying to do, perhaps, is to counterbalance the Fatah and the leadership in Ramallah.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Israel and Hamas, the Palestinians this time. Israeli troops massed along the border of Gaza, rockets flying out of Gaza in great number in recent weeks and days, heavy Israeli airstrikes on Gaza just in the last few days. Somewhere around 100 casualties in Gaza now, many of them civilian. We've seen them, families, children, the works. It is crowded. You go violent there, and a lot of people die. They have already. Of course, air raid sirens, people in shelters in Israel and in parts of Israel where they are not accustomed to that, all the way to Tel Aviv. It's quite the picture coming out of there right now, and the real possibility of a ground incursion. Natan Sachs is with us. He's a fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, joins us from Washington, as does Robert Malley, director of the Middle East and North Africa Program at the International Crisis Group. We've got lots of response online, Natan. Robert, Greg says, here's Egypt's opportunity to show that a popular revolution can lead to a responsible country. Egypt should use its influence to rein in Hamas. Then here's Catherine. She writes, I'm an American living in the West Bank. Americans have no clue what's happening here, talking about Israeli occupation, I guess. And the traditional media, she says, is complicit. Looking at Gaza, she writes, this is a violent assault on a primarily civilian population. Well, there you've got it. Rachel's calling from Ra'anana, Israel. Rachel, thanks very much for calling. Hi, what do you see?
So, my perspective, I'm from Wellesley, Massachusetts. I own a home there, and we took our kids to Israel for a year. Okay. We're getting a little more than we bargained for.
Yeah.
But I have to say, the perspective of Israelis, the people around me, I'm shocked about the media perspective and maybe many American perspective about an Israeli assault. The feeling here is rockets have been raining down on the south for so long that people have resolved that we should end this, that to show the Palestinians that we won't be subjected to this. My daily life, I go to sleep, I put my four kids to sleep, I sleep with my ears half open, listening to whether we need to wake the kids in the middle of the night. We have about a minute and 30 seconds to get to a safe room. And around here, everyone knows someone who is in the army, a brother, a child, a sister, a friend. And I think it is this mistaken notion that Israel is interested in something other than security.
Rachel, it must be terrifying. We can just imagine how frightening that is and to be there with children. But when you say Israel needs to show that it will end this, what does that mean? Reverse Ariel Sharon's decision, go in, reoccupy Gaza, flatten Gaza? I mean, what does that mean?
I think there is a sense that we will not tolerate the terror. I mean, I think Israel, everyone in Israel would like peace. The Palestinians want to land. We are willing to negotiate. The point, the Palestinians will not start at the starting point of Israel's right to exist. So when you have an enemy who says they don't, we would like to annihilate Israel, how, where is your negotiating stance? When you, I mean, the feeling is we just want peace. You know, everyone's child, a brother, a family member is in the military. We don't want to see our friends and our loved ones involved in a war. It is not gratuitous.
Rachel, we've got that perspective, and we hear exactly where you're coming from in Israel, not that far from Gaza there. We hope you will be safe. Robert Malley, what do you say to that perspective? You know, the assertion there, Israel wants peace. It's willing to give land. It's willing to negotiate. It's just, it has an adamant opponent that just isn't really interested. How does that strike your ear, Robert, having watched this for a long time?
I think it's very important to hear what Rachel said. And if you had a caller from either the West Bank or Gaza, you'd get the full picture of the conflict. You'd get exactly two sides, which are polar opposite ways of looking at the conflict. And it's true that the situation in Gaza and, by the way, in the West Bank is intolerable. And the problem that we've seen, we saw it in 2008. The war in Gaza was resolved with a Band-Aid, and it never got to the roots of the problem. It didn't address the real security concerns that Israel has with the transfer of weapons into Gaza. And it certainly didn't address the problems that the Gazans had about restoring and resuming a normal life. And meanwhile, you have the fact that the occupation continues in the West Bank. The Palestinians still are hoping for their statehood and their freedom. And Israel feels likewise that those in the West Bank are not prepared to negotiate with it. So until we get to the roots of the problem in both places, I think you're going to get calls like Rachel's, and you get a similar call from a Palestinian, wherever he or she may be. And until we try to do more than simply either waging war to try to solve a problem, but it's not going to be solved that way, or not going to the root of the problem in terms of the occupation, I think this dialogue of the deaf will continue.
It'd be great to get to the root of it if we could only reach it. It always seems somehow permanently out of reach. Mark in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. First, let me open my remarks by saying I think the idea of rockets falling on civilian population areas is just preposterous. But having said that, I think this, and I have empathy for the woman in Israel who just called, but by the same token, what I think is being missed in the West, and this keeps happening every single time we go through one of these cycles, Israel's policy is very clear. It's not a question of what they say. It's a question of what they do. It is in their best interests to maintain an occupation. It is in their best interests to slowly use these rockets as rationale to expand their colonies, to expand the usurpation of Palestine land, which even Israel acknowledges isn't theirs to begin with.
Why would it be in Israel's best interest? Why would it be in Israel's best interest to have that agenda in your narrative, Mark?
Well, I mean, in the first place, it's ethnic cleansing. It's gradually taking more and more land. That is to a benefit of a growing economy and a growing social entity. But if Israel was truly interested in getting rid of these rockets, they could do it in a much more preemptive manner. If they know that these rockets are coming through tunnels, why wait till there's this buildup of rockets that start falling and then use that as a pretext? Well, the rockets are falling. Why not just carpet bomb these tunnels day after day after day and prevent the rockets from coming in?
Well, let us pick it up right there. Natan, respond first on that. I mean, I assume there's a lot coming through those tunnels, food and other stuff not least, so that would have its own consequences. But what about that? Could they have been intercepted earlier? And what about the larger assertion from Mark that he doesn't see a real commitment here to peace, that it's more about occupation and more land?
Well, I think taking the last two calls together, I think, points to some of the misconception about what's going on there. Part of the problem, I think, as Rachel in Israel pointed out, is that the attention, our all attention here, is pointed at this problem when we see a flare-up. But in the recent weeks, there have been dozens of rockets hitting Israel. And for Israelis, these were the headlines. That is what Israelis were paying attention to.
More than
to,
dozens, I think, from what I'm reading.
Oh, absolutely.
But anyway, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And these are the headlines in Israel. There's a large proportion of the Israeli population that's in range. And today, as we heard, even Ra'anana, which is north of Tel Aviv, now has sirens. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, the attention from the West usually is diverted to other issues, sometimes rightfully so. The Israeli perspective on Gaza is that there are absolutely no colonies in Gaza. In fact, this is what happened in the disengagement from Gaza.
But keep the West Bank in here. I mean, that, our caller certainly does not look at the West Bank and Gaza as entirely unrelated.
Absolutely. And that division is crucial, and it's crucial to what Rachel pointed out earlier. The question of who to negotiate with and how is tremendously important. And going forward, when we think about a deeper solution to these issues, that is where it lies. Hamas, on the one hand, is unwilling to even discuss Israel's right to exist or any kind of lasting peace. It's willing to discuss ceasefires at best. In Ramallah, there is a leadership that is not only willing to discuss Israel's right to exist, but has accepted it, has negotiated, has talked about pragmatic solutions. The division between Hamas in Gaza and the Ramallah government led by Fatah and President Abbas is one of the major obstacles to advancing forward. And a long-term solution at the end of the day will have to take into account Palestinian reconciliation between the two sides, a restoration of some kind of normalcy, in the context of which border crossings and the tunnels, et cetera, would have to be regulated, would have to become into the normal way of conducting business.
Robert, has Israel done all it can to help with that easing of tensions between Fatah and Hamas or otherwise?
No, it certainly, I mean, it has no, from its perspective, from the current government's perspective, they don't want to see a reconciliation between the two. They'd like to, I mean, whether
Why?
They like the division or not. Well, they don't want to see Hamas anywhere near the Palestinian government. I mean, some would be more cynical than say that by keeping them divided, you keep them weak and you actually have this, one of the reasons why negotiations can't go forward. But regardless, the fact is that Israel takes the position that Hamas, being a terrorist organization, it shouldn't be part of the government. And if it were, Israel would not be prepared to
But it is the government in Gaza.
Well, it rules Gaza, but it's not recognized as the government by most. So it's sort of a de facto leadership, but one that so far Israel has not been prepared to consider the legitimate government. Although I think one of the subtexts that we're seeing here, one of the possible outcomes, could be that Israel formalizes arrangements with Gaza through Egypt, which leads to a kind of coexistence with Hamas, which might be fine for Hamas, fine in terms of the security situation. The losers on the other end, and they tend to be the losers these days, would be President Abbas, would be Fatah, would be the project of a two-state solution, because that would be really put at the on the back burner as Israel deals sort of serially with Gaza as a issue of coexistence and security arrangements, and likewise with the West Bank. And I think if we go back to one point Rachel said, it's important to know the Palestinian perspective, and I think Natan or one of your callers made the point, they don't only listen to words that Prime Minister Netanyahu is prepared to negotiate. They look at what's happening on the ground. They look at settlement construction. They look at acts which, to them, and don't forget that they've been living these negotiations now for two decades, fruitless negotiations. So for their perspective, when they hear the rhetoric, they don't believe it, and they don't want to go back into these negotiations without a greater sense of certainty that they, in fact, these negotiations will succeed in giving them statehood.
Let's go to Elaine in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Elaine, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
First of all, there's no occupation. Israel left Gaza August 05, 7 years ago.
No occupation in Gaza, but yes, in the West Bank.
I'm talking about Gaza
yeah,
now.
Okay.
So it's the Palestinians' fault. It's their fault, and now Hamas for raining these rockets in every couple of years and all the time. Israel wants to live in peace, and we're sick of the liberal media always blaming Israel. So, of course, after hundreds of rockets over the last weekend, gentlemen, Israel, of course, took the leader of Hamas out. 8,000 rockets. I mean, some of your callers, oh, they get rockets in Israel. They poo-poo it. 8,000 rockets since 05. They expect Israel to absorb that? Your listeners, we couldn't believe this. And listen, also, please, the Palestinians let Hamas put rockets in their homes. So it's too bad if civilians are killed. We're sick and tired of Israel having their hands behind their back. This is never going to stop. Obama brought in his best friends, Hamas, Morsi, to destroy Israel. People are blaming Obama for this.
Elaine, I think we got the perspective loud and clear here. I don't hear anybody poo-pooing really either side in this, but we certainly hear your fervor right there. If I may, let me get one more. Duly noted, Elaine. One more right here. Jeffrey in Newton, Massachusetts. Jeffrey, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks for the show and for having such thoughtful people on the show. I'm talking about your guests. We've seen this movie before. There are rockets that come over. Israel responds or Israel begins, and there are rockets that end up being the response. We know how it will hopefully end, which is with a ceasefire sooner rather than later. My question to your guests is, where do we go from there? How do we get back on track? And it may seem far-fetched at this moment, but how do we get back on track to a peace process that can lead to a two-state solution? And let me give you just two examples quickly.
Okay.
In today's Haaretz, you have Ami Ayalon, certainly no peacenik. Certainly, he was a former commander of the Navy and head of the Shin Bet, calling on Israel to support the UN bid by Abbas. And then you also have a group of Palestinian and Israeli peace NGOs that met last week in Jericho to talk about a two-state solution, even amidst the assassination of Jaberi and all that we knew would be coming. So how do we get back on track here to something that's more productive?
Jeffrey, thank you very much for your call. Natan, let me put that first to you. Is there a potent lobby in Israel to get negotiation back on track, and how might that happen toward peace instead of what we're looking at today?
Well, part of the tragedy of the situation is that the Palestinian issue in general, and especially the prospects of two-state solution, have become quite low on the Israeli agenda, and that's partly simply because of a deep lack of trust on both sides. As Rob mentioned earlier, this is shared by Palestinians, or even more so by Palestinians. But for Israelis today, the chief concerns, especially in this electoral cycle, have been Iran, have been domestic issues of economic questions and redistribution, and much less so the Palestinian question. And to the degree that the Palestinian issue is on the agenda, it is mostly vis-a-vis Gaza and Hamas and how to stop the rocket fire on Israeli civilians, much less so a question of some kind of constructive negotiation with Abbas or someone else.
But isn't peace ultimately the way to stop those rockets? I mean, we've seen how hard it is to stop them in the absence of peace.
Ultimately, yes, absolutely. But a previous caller actually mentioned the rapid changes in the region, the Arab Spring, as it's called, or other names. And from the Israeli perspective, this is a situation that is so volatile. So many parts are moving. Egypt is changing rapidly. Syria is, of course, in the throes of a civil war. Many other countries may go down that route. And from the Israeli perspective, what they are seeing right now is a need to hunker down and prevent any deep losses before they can move in a bold way. And the division between Hamas and the West Bank is especially worrying from that perspective, because Israelis do not see any partner for peace in Hamas. At best, perhaps a ceasefire that's backed by deterrence. But Hamas itself never suggests that it is willing to truly discuss peace. And so I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but the cynicism about the prospects of a two-state solution, the cynicism is high these days on both sides.
Robert Malley, what about it? How to get from preventing deep losses to the possibility of real progress for peace here? What's the daylight? Is there some?
I can't disagree with Natan's generally skeptical tone, but let me say that the most amazing aspect of this conflict is how little we learn from the past. And I'm not talking about ancient past. When it comes to Gaza, rather than simply think that through launching rockets or, on the Israel's part, pounding the Gaza Strip, you're going to get anywhere, let's try to see whether there's an outcome in which Egypt could play a role to stop the weapon smuggling, to stop the firing of rockets, and to give those in Gaza and Hamas a political and economic stake in calm. And that's not happened for the last since 2008. We haven't learned our lesson about reconciliation. A divided Palestinian entity cannot move boldly. And third, let's learn the lessons about the failure of the peace process of the past, take into account the new changes in the region, and reinvent a peace process that this time hopefully can succeed.
All that as we watch the very real-time teetering here. Still the possibility that Israeli troops may go into Gaza, we don't know. The talks go on in Cairo. I'm very grateful to both of you, for our listeners, for their perspectives today. Natan Sachs at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Natan, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Robert Malley with the International Crisis Group. Robert, thanks as always for being here. We hope it's a better context next time, but thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks to you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.